Vibrations Podcast, Episode 47, David Bellis. Recorded Wednesday, the 10th of April, 2024. Hi, I'm Gary Brightman, and this is my periodic podcast called Vibrations. Established in 2018, Vibe is a book and music shop situated in Mui Wo, on Lantau Island, in Hong Kong. Well, it's been a while. My last Vibrations podcast was an interview with Anna Robb of Cirque du Soleil and House of Dancing Water fame back in August 2023. And since that time, we've had many events at Vibe, including author talks from Jane Hung, Patricia O'Sullivan and David Bellis, and music gigs from Harper Shelley Cox, Glenn Alfred and rapper SJ the Artisan. You can watch all of these events on our YouTube channel at Live at Vibe HK. We're currently in the process of planning many more gigs, including Mary Jane and Graham and the Sirens, to name a few. On May the 18th, it's our 6th birthday anniversary, and we'll be celebrating with DJ sets from myself, DJ Gazim, DJ Solman Rushdie, and DJ Eclectic Selector. We'll also be joined by Vibe favourite Andy Tate and friends for a live music gig, and you're all invited. Like most independent businesses in Mui Wo on Lantau Island these days, we struggle to make ends meet and so value your support. And so to this week's interview with Guulo's David Bellis. Writing about history was never the plan. David left school with a firm dislike of both English and history. He studied computer science, then worked as a software engineer. But in 1992, a move to Hong Kong meant having to find a new job in a hurry and forced to switch from programming to sales. That led to writing newsletters to keep customers updated. And as he found, it was surprisingly satisfying. He also started writing a blog as a hobby. A new baby caused the next upheaval. David quit the sales job to spend less time travelling, expanded the blog into a website, and narrowed its focus to Hong Kong's history. He still wrote newsletters though, and found that sharing an old photo from his collection and inviting readers to explore its hidden details helped make the history easier to digest. The newsletters, photos and stories meant he had enough material to start giving talks, and as the talks were well received, he used them as a foundation for a book. David has since published 5 books in the Old Hong Kong Photos and the Tales They Tell series. Meanwhile, the website, guulo.com, continues to grow, and now hosts over 50,000 pages about Old Hong Kong, including over 35,000 photos. David's work on the site was recognised by a Heritage Preservation Award from the South China Morning Post, one of their Spirit of Hong Kong Awards. David gave an excellent talk at Vibe recently on some of the historic Hong Kong photos appearing in Volume 5. This talk can be viewed on our YouTube channel at Live at Vibe HK. Okay, so welcome to Vibe, David.
Thanks, Gary. Good to be back again.
Good, good. And as we do, we're going to start off with our 10 warm-up questions. So the first question is, do you have a favourite book or author?
You were just telling me how hard it is for people to choose one, and I had exactly that. So I've looked at my bookshelf, which is the rattiest book, and it's Mapping Hong Kong by Hal Empson. It's just about falling apart.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've ever seen it. It's a big coffee table
book. Yeah.
And what a shame it's out of print. It was done by the government, and it's just this beautiful collection of big old maps, and I can look at maps for hours. I just love them.
Yeah, absolutely. And I agree. And that book came through this bookshop, and it was Anne-Marie Evans did a Hong Kong heritage talk about that book. And afterwards I thought, I think I've got that book.
Yeah.
And luckily I found, I've got that book. And that made me go through it, and I thought, this is
one of the... It's fantastic, because Hong Kong is you know, always changing, as you know.
Yeah.
And this, you can go right back to the 1840s, the very first maps of the city, and just see it grow over the years.
Yeah. 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 Wonderful, wonderful book. Right. So, where are your musical interests laying? So,
well, I guess like a lot of people, it's probably around when you're like your late teens, early 20s.
Yes.
So I think one of the highlights was going to see U2 in Cardiff.
Okay.
So I definitely say U2. And
yeah. Then
looking down the Spotify of what turns up most often, Smashing Pumpkins. I'd never listened to them until, I think it must have come up on one of those random recommendations.
Yes.
2-3 years ago. And yeah, they pop up often now.
Yeah, good old Seattle grunge band, aren't they? From around the Nirvana times. And I would agree with you, my teenage years really shaped my whole interest in music, you know, so totally get the U2 thing and the Smashing Pumpkins. Okay, favourite films?
The ones I like are the ones that they're a bit of fun.
Yeah.
They're the ones I go back to.
Yeah.
So like you see something like an Oppenheimer and you come out and think, oh, that was a good film, but I probably wouldn't go and see it again.
Yes.
The ones that will... just say, oh, how about watching that again, would be things like Groundhog Day, Jerry Maguire, Something's Gotta Give. You're usually pretty light-hearted, something along those lines.
Preferred drink?
I do like a London Pride. We did the guided tour of the Fuller's Brewery a couple of years back, so that was funny because they were saying that London Pride is now your dad's beer. So no young people would be seen dead drinking it. That was a real problem for them. So now there's a cloudy London Pride,
right,
which is what you drink if you're young and hip.
Like, okay, I see it.
You're an old fart like us, then we have the London Pride.
That's funny, isn't it? We've now reached the age that our fathers were, that we used to take
the
mickey out of them. We are the dads. Okay, do you have a life motto?
I do like It's a Funny Old Life. You'll probably hear me say that at regular intervals.
Yeah.
And I think that probably goes back to the Life of Brian's and whatever. You know, life's just quite ridiculous. So talking about how we've ended up where we are, but where we started out, it's not the usual career path. So it's just funny how it turns out.
Yeah.
Funny old life.
Funny old life. Absolutely. Thank God for that, really. Favourite Hong Kong walk?
Yeah, there's one that we used to do when the girls were younger. We haven't done it so much now, but it's get the ferry to Yong Shui Wan. Walk across Lama, head off to Lo So Sing Beach.
Okay.
Spend the afternoon there, have a good swim, back to Sok Wu Wan, have the seafood dinner, and go home. And on a sunny day, can't beat it, even on a, you know, autumn day. Beautiful.
Yeah. Yeah, and then that's the beauty of living here, isn't it, in a way? You can do that, you can have that day out, and it's all...
Yeah, then back on a ferry and you're back in the middle of Central, and
it's
so it's all on your doorstep.
You're back in the hubbub again.
Yeah.
Hong Kong restaurant.
The Globe I mentioned earlier, that would be a favourite. Go and have a steak kidney pie.
Yeah,
I do like their pies. I enjoy the Indian food. We'll go to Branto's over in Tasty.
Right.
Veggie Indian, that's good.
What about the best advice you were given?
Well, not quite advice, but one of those sort of... having ended up writing stuff and putting it out in public, the idea that you can't please all the people all the time...
Yes.
I just find very reassuring, because when I started, I used to get really upset when people didn't like something I was doing.
Yes.
And it's funny, you can have 10 people say, that's great, and then one person comes and says, oh, you know, you're a fraud or whatever.
Yes.
And I would really dwell on the one bad one instead of...
Yes.
So just trying to remember that you can't please all the people all the time. And,
and
if they're not enjoying it, well, there's plenty of other stuff to
and do. So finish this sentence. I live in Hong Kong because
it's a funny old life. I was on the way to Australia and I stopped here on the way, and I did end up going on to Australia. It was the working holiday visa time,
right? Okay.
So I could go there for a year, and while I was there I was just found I was really missing Hong Kong, and I signed up for a Cantonese night class and just got ready to come back here. So I had to go back to the UK to be best man for a couple of friends.
Yes.
And after that, it was just save up and come back to Hong Kong again.
You were going to Australia. What year would that have been in, roughly?
89.
In 89, yeah. So at the end of the 80s, you flew and you did a stopover for what, a few days or?
Well, no, because it was that time when I got the visa, it said, oh, you've got up to a year to arrive, which I didn't realise.
Okay.
And I thought...
Okay, that's good. I didn't know that.
Yeah, so that gave you this flexibility. And at that point, you could get off the plane with a UK passport.
Yeah.
You didn't need a visa or anything in Hong Kong. You could just look for work. So I thought, I'll give it a go.
Yeah.
Yeah. So ended up Chungking Mansions, as the guidebooks sent me there.
Yeah.
And then I rented a room in Kimberley Street.
Right. And just started the corner,
desperately looking for work.
Wow.
Managed to get some work in a local software house.
Yes.
And that paid the bills. And then did that pretty much up until the day that I had to go to Australia and start.
Okay. That lasted almost a year then.
About 8 months, I think I was
about
here.
8 months, yeah.
So long enough to get a feel for the place and
also go from...
I arrived in October and I'd left frosty Britain to come to October Hong Kong.
Oh, God.
I thought I've arrived in heaven.
You have arrived in heaven, haven't you? God, October from that. Yeah, it's just chalk and cheese, isn't it? It's just such a great place.
But then I was here long enough to go through the mouldy February, March, and the hot summer. Yeah. You have seen a bit of everything then, and still liked it. So
yeah,
came back with my eyes open after that.
Yeah, it's a shock, isn't it? The first summer you live here, I think you're like, when's this gonna end?
Yeah.
You know, and people are saying survive the summer and all this sort of stuff, and you're like, aircon becomes your best friend and everything. So
I'm just looking at you with a beard, which is a good thing to manage to keep. I arrived with a beard, but I think, come about April, I thought, oh,
it's got to go.
Too hot, yeah. At the end of the beard.
Do you have a favourite area of Hong Kong?
Now, this was a bit of a toss-up for the earlier question about a favourite Hong Kong walk. We go to the Tai Lung Wan, that big beach north of Sai Kung.
Oh, yes, yes.
Ham Tin, Tai Lung Wan.
Yeah.
That's just beautiful.
Yeah.
And that's another moment where you think, well, I've been transported to this whole other...
Yeah.
Country almost.
Yeah, that's not doesn't seem like Hong Kong, isn't it? It's funny you should say that because I have friends that live in Sai Kung and I've just started to go up there once every other week and go walking up there. So I'm just really starting to explore. I've been to Sai Kung, my brother lived there for a while, but properly explore it now. And it does have that totally different vibe, as you say.
Yeah, and up in the northeast, up towards Sa Tau Kwok, a bit further north.
Yeah.
You've got like the abandoned villages. And there's a spot we went through a couple of years back that we came to this ruined village and there was quite a crowd of people and the path had been really quiet. We didn't know what was going on.
Yeah.
And there was these beautiful cascading vines with loads of lovely flowers on.
Oh,
and we just happened to have turned up in the couple of weeks.
It was there.
We went there last week thinking we'd timed it right.
And
there was just a pile of dead flowers on the floor. And so it was a long walk for nothing.
It's a game of two halves.
Yeah. But if you catch it right, it's quite stunning.
Yeah, it's then that you can realise how lucky you were, really, isn't it? Okay, so, David, that's the questions over with. What we're going to do now is perhaps take a few little steps back to your life prior to living in Hong Kong. Where did you come from? Where did you live? And what precipitated that move to want to go and live in Australia?
The visit to Australia, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I'm from a very small town in southwest Wales in Pembrokeshire.
Okay.
Milford Haven on the sea.
Oh, I've heard of that, yes.
All right. It's known for its harbour. So years ago it was a big fishing port.
Yes.
And now it's an oil port and that's evolved now into a liquid, is it LNG? LNG.
Oh, okay. Right.
So that's where a lot of the UK's LNG comes in.
Okay.
I mean, it's a beautiful area for beaches and countryside, but it's a long way from anywhere and it's not a great place for finding work.
No.
So, as most friends, got to about 18, did your A-levels, went away to uni. With a friend there, we were talking about, we should go and do that working holiday in Australia.
Yeah.
And then it all fell apart because I'd got into a relationship with a woman that in Reading, where I was. So that all fell to pieces. And I got in touch with my friend Howard and said, okay, Howard, I'm a free man. Let's do that Australia thing. And he says, oh, sorry, Dave. I've just met the love of my life. I cannot leave. So I thought,
yes. They've got a lot to answer for.
I thought, I'll go and give it a go anyway. So got the visa, applied for the visa. I think you could do it until you're 26, and I was about 25 at the time, so I had about a year. And dropped off in Hong Kong first. I knew you could do that, so I thought we'll give that a try. And ended up staying here about 8 months.
Okay.
And carried on to Australia with some friends that I'd met here. We did Thailand and Malaysia and Singapore, to like a little trip down through there. That was the Days of the Lonely Planet book.
Yeah, yeah.
And then on to Australia, which was a big shock. So I remember we flew in over Melbourne.
Right,
and it's all red brick terraced houses. So we'd had this time in Asia, and then all of a sudden it's like you're suddenly back in Britain, and yet you're on the other side of the world.
Yeah.
Very odd.
Yeah.
Got beetroot in the burgers.
Yeah, exactly. What's all that about? I mean, it was Melbourne that you headed
for?
No,
that was just
just that you landed?
That was a stopover. I was ended the flight in Sydney.
Okay.
And spent, I guess, 5 or 6 months in Sydney. Had a very good time there.
Yeah.
Then we went up to Cairns and did about a month.
Love Cairns.
We come across WOOF, it's called, Willing Workers on Organic Farms.
No.
Yeah, you sent off to this address and they sent you back a photocopied, stapled book. This is all before the internet.
Yeah.
And then you could contact any of the farms and say, yeah, have you got space?
Right.
And you go along and you do like a half day's work and then they'd give you board and lodging.
Okay, perfect.
So, yeah, visited a few places around Cairns and what was it called? Atherton Tablelands, I think was the name.
Okay, so you went up to Cairns. So from there
I hitchhiked from there to Darwin up the top. So that was interesting. So you go down to, can't remember, there's a port. I mean, the map of Australia is really simple. There's a road down the coast. There's a road to the middle, which joins the road that goes up the middle.
Yes.
And you head up there and you come to Darwin. That was the spot where the crossroad meets the stop at the up road. I think it's called Three Ways. They're not very adventurous with their names, Three Ways. And yeah, that was my most miserable hitchhiking experience ever, because you had flies by the gazillion.
Really?
And it was so hot. When somebody finally picked me up, I drank a couple of litres of water and I suddenly started sweating, and I think I'd just been so dehydrated that I stopped sweating.
You stopped sweating, which is dangerous.
So that was a lucky moment.
That's a long way to hitchhike.
That was,
So how many hundred miles is that? Any idea?
It's probably into the thousand, I
thousands,
guess.
Thousands, yeah.
But it was, it took several days.
So you get up to Darwin and spend a bit of time there.
Yeah, spend a bit of time there and then flew back to Hong Kong. A few weeks seeing friends. And then I got the boat up to Shanghai. That was when there were still boats running. That was interesting. Yeah, we had a moment where we had a chance to have a disco. And somebody in our group had Michael Jackson on their cassette tape. And so we were all just bopping away, and we noticed all the Chinese ladies were looking at our feet. And we worked out that they were trying to know what the steps were. There wasn't this idea of just flailing around as we normally do. That must be a very complicated dance to learn.
And they probably didn't realise you're all doing improvising, totally different.
Making it up as you go along. Yeah. So from arriving in Shanghai, little while around Shanghai, and then train. So train up to Beijing, and then train across to Russia and back, the long train ride.
Okay, so you actually headed back to the UK
by
land.
Yeah, that was
interesting. Fantastic.
Yeah.
That's a really, I wish I had the imagination to do what you did at that age. I'm very impressed with that, actually.
Oh, it was good fun. You had a very different experience depending on your coach. There was one man that we met, you'd always see him sitting in the corridor. You'd never see him sitting in his cabin. We asked and he pulled back the door. And you know those red, white and blue bags that people have
for
when they're moving usually?
Yeah.
So his whole cabin was chock full of those. And it was Chinese traders were taking stuff up to Russia to sell.
Oh, okay.
So there was no room. He could just squeeze through a gap and get onto his bunk to go to sleep.
Oh, so he used
otherwise you'd have to sit on the seat in the corridor.
So he filled his cabin with those big bags, like the Filipinos.
Not him. The other three people in his cabin were the Chinese traders.
Okay.
They'd filled it up, and he was the poor guy with no...
were worth more than him. So you eventually got back to the UK. That would have been sort of early 90s, would it?
Yeah, where are we up to? 91, I think. 91.
And then what happened? Did you have some urge to move to Hong Kong then after that? Was that because that was the highlight of that trip?
Yeah, very much. Australia, I'd been learning the Cantonese and I was all looking forward to going back to Hong Kong. I had to go back to the UK, a couple of weddings that I needed to be a best man at. And then after that, it was find a job and just save up enough to be able to fly back to Hong Kong again.
Yeah, so yeah.
That was the goal. I came back in 92 and then been here since.
Okay. Yeah, that was about the time my brother moved here, I think, 91, 92. Good times here in Hong Kong, and a different landscape to what you see today.
Yeah.
The harbour was not as reclaimed as it is now. At that point, then, what do? You land in Hong Kong. Where do you live? How do you find a job? Are you confident you can find a job? And what skill sets are you selling?
That's a good question. I'd been here before and I had found a job. So I had a feeling that something will work out.
Yeah.
And we were chatting earlier about there always seems to be some opportunity in Hong Kong. Yeah. Someone somewhere will find something that they think, if they like you and think you can do a decent job, you'll end up doing something. Maybe not what you originally planned.
Yes.
But
yeah.
One of the friends that I'd gone down through Asia with, he was coming back as well.
Right.
So we knew we'd rent a flat together.
Okay, that helps, doesn't it?
Did a flat share, that was good. And then, get out, start looking for work, and ended up in more of an IT support role, like a company that did tech support for other companies.
Okay.
And we were just at that lucky last step, because at that point, all of the things that you did with computers and PCs was all in English.
Right, yes.
So speaking English gave you this just huge advantage.
Edge, yeah.
And it was just at the transition when they were starting to introduce Chinese data input and Chinese display.
Right.
And then when Windows came out, when a Chinese Windows,
yes.
Then suddenly my lack of Chinese was a great liability again. So that was a switch to more like selling software.
Yeah, okay. Yes, yeah, so that kind of put you out of work in that respect. So then where do you go from there?
Then I was selling software and started my own company and was a distributor of software for a while.
Okay.
And got lucky with, don't know if you remember, WAP, it was all about sort of an early internet on the mobile phones.
Yes.
We had some software that was pretty good in that area.
Yeah, okay.
So that did very well.
Yeah.
And then the company that supplied got bought out and I ended up going and working for them.
Right.
So that was a few years with that. And then when our second daughter was born, I was having to do quite a lot of regional travel.
Yeah.
And we said, well, do we really want to keep doing this 1 or 2 weeks away each month? It'd be better if I was at home. And that's when we started doing the...
Was that historic?
No, it wasn't. It was about the expat life in Hong Kong.
Okay.
Not very original. Yeah. And
well, it is to people not in Hong Kong.
Well, people who are visiting and people who are arriving, it was quite handy.
Yeah.
And my partner in crime, Ross, is a very good writer. It's these sort of openings into the hill below the Kowloon Park.
Okay.
And just asking, what were they and what...
Yeah.
Started a conversation. Turns out they were the old air raid shelters.
Okay.
From the Second World War.
Right.
There's this great network of tunnels under the Kowloon Park.
So along sort of Haifong Road.
The entrances are along Canton Road.
Canton Road at the side.
And Austin Road at that end.
Okay.
Yeah.
You've got that big sort of wall sort of area up there, haven't you? It's quite high.
Yes. Yeah. And there are, if you know where to look, if you've got that train spotter gene, there's a few little places where there's vents in the wall and you can feel like a draft coming out.
Okay.
So they've been covered over now, but those are the old entrances to the
right
the tunnels.
So underneath Kowloon Park is a air raid shelter. There's rooms under there.
Yeah, great long tunnels. Under there. And then these are all over Hong Kong. So like Leighton Hill has another big network.
Right.
So that was one of those forks in the road where we just started writing more and more about history. And I always joke that Hong Kong history is just a lot more interesting than my expat life. So that's the way we went.
Yeah. And I think that's true with all respect, isn't it? I mean, I'm a big fan of Hong Kong history as well.
Yeah.
There's a great depth to it. And then here we are today. You've got this website now with 35,000 odd photos on it, which you maintain yourself, or is anybody involved with you?
It's a mix. So for the maintaining the software and doing the admin work, that's me.
Yes.
But of course, the stories and the photos get contributed by a lot of people. So that going back to the Bat Kong, that was truly a blog. That was Ross and me, and we were writing everything that went up on the site.
Yes.
But as we switched to Gulo, the stuff I write now is a small part of of the whole. You know, it's coming from a large group of people.
Right. For the people that don't understand how Gulo works, do you want to just explain how long you've been going for, where you're at now, what you went from and to with that?
So it started off with that post in 2006 with the Bat Kong. And then when we got to about 2009, one of our readers wrote in really and said, you've become two different things and you're trying to jam them together and it's not working.
Yeah.
So we split the history stuff out into gulo.com.
Okay.
So Gulo is another Cantonese,
just
means sort of old-fashioned or ancient, something like that. And the reason for these odd names, it's really hard to get short domain name.
Yeah.
So if you choose something a bit odd, then it's probably still available.
Yeah.
The bad news of picking Gulo is it sounds like Guilo, and I'd never thought of it. So still today, people will write in and say, don't you think you're spelling it quite right?
Yeah, I know. People do go straight to that Guilo thing, don't they? I must admit I did to start with, and then you think, no, you're just overthinking this. So
it started off with sort of odd stories, a bit like the blog style. And then the software that I used to run the site, I changed to be a more feature-rich software.
Yeah.
And that allows people to upload pictures.
Right.
So that was the first big step. Since then, it didn't have a big plan, but what I've tended to do is run it until something's not working and then try and find a solution. So
yes,
when people started adding pictures to start with, they'd want to write about the picture. But if you've got 10 photos of, let's say, the old HSBC building, you end up with a little bit of the story on each of the photos.
Yeah.
And if one of them's got something wrong, then, you know, how do you correct?
Yes.
So you start thinking, well, and, you know, from your database background, it's all about normalize the database and pull the buildings out into their own page.
Yes.
So now we have photos and we have buildings and we link them together, which the internet is great at.
Yes.
And then we started I think the project I'm most proud of is it's one called the Wartime Diaries project. So the idea is take diaries that were written during the wartime in Hong Kong.
Yeah.
And that's nothing very new. There's a few of those are out there. But we chop them up, so we've got now everything is day by day.
Okay.
And then we reassemble them to show you one day's diary entries. So 3rd of May 1943.
Okay.
Here's all, and again, you can think simple database lookup.
Pull
them all together.
With multiple authors, presumably.
With multiple authors.
So you're calling out for people, did you write a diary in Stanley Prison or whatever on these days?
Are you willing to share it with the public? Can you supply it as a text file?
Yeah.
But, you know, ideally, but we have had some where they've come to us as scans and volunteers have typed them up.
Right, so JPEGs or PDFs.
That's right,
or whatever.
Whatever. And you could just take a picture with your phone these days.
Yeah, and you've got OCR as well these days, haven't you?
No, that's handwriting.
Okay. Doesn't work well for.
Or at least it didn't. Maybe it's better now.
So
the end result then is that on every year at about 1st of December, which is, you know, just before the war started, I'll start a new cycle. I'll invite people to subscribe.
Yeah.
And then every morning they'll get an email with today's diary.
Okay.
And they'll follow it. And a lot of people stick with it and they'll follow it right through for the 4 years. from the war, yeah, outbreak of war. And the first bit is very dramatic.
It's, yes,
the fighting and, yes, the deaths and the hardships. And then there's the going into the camps.
Yes.
And a lot of it can be quite dull and repetitive.
It's, yeah,
you know, one guy just writes about the weather every day.
Yeah.
But
they're in shock, I guess, aren't they?
Well,
in the level of PTSD or...
Well, there is that, but also, mm, you know, you're stuck in a fairly small space with a couple of thousand, yeah, 3,000 people. Not a lot of variety in your daily life, but
yeah,
there would be dramatic events breaking up. So in the, like, 1942, the Americans are allowed to go home. They,
yeah,
get onto a repatriation ship and they're sent away.
Yeah.
1943, there's a group of people are taken out to a execution range at Stanley and they're,
right,
beheaded.
Yeah.
That's a real low point in the life there.
Yeah.
There are American bombers start coming. That's kind of seen as a very positive sign in,
yeah,
in the camp. It's a sign that the Allies haven't forgotten about Hong Kong.
Yes, yeah.
But one of the American bombs mistakenly drops a bomb into the camp and kills people. So you've got these ups and downs.
Yes.
And then through 45, people are worrying whether they're going to make it.
Right.
Because the food is just,
yeah,
getting very limited.
Sparse and
very easy to get sick. And
yeah,
and then, of course, all of a sudden, the liberation. And the reason that people finally believe it after the rumours,
yeah,
is that they're all given the toilet roll. For the first time in the camp, they're given a toilet roll.
Wow.
Which is named the victory roll. And they go, okay, no, something is definitely happening. And suddenly
the
Japanese and the Taiwanese people were all being very friendly and helpful. And they go, okay, that
yeah,
must be the
tables
end.
Have turned here a bit.
Yes.
There's a book in that, surely.
There have been a few. Yeah, in fact,
yes,
one of the first diaries we had was Barbara Anslow.
Yes, yes.
Her book, Tin Hats,
yes,
and Rice.
Yes, we've had it here, yeah.
Right,
yeah.
So that...
Yeah, Pete's very good at these books, isn't he?
Yes.
Blacksmiths.
Yes, he's done quite a few with a wartime connection.
Yeah.
So her diary came to Kuulo, and then as I was posting it up, I'd go back to Barbara and ask questions.
Yes.
Luckily, she was
still
with us.
101, I think, when she wrote the book, wasn't she?
Just in the late 90s, yeah.
Right.
And then all of that extra commentary was able to go back into the book then, so that,
right,
that was a good thing. But yeah, the feedback,
excellent,
from people has been that, especially if you had someone who was there and didn't talk about it.
Yes.
Which was not uncommon. People just didn't talk about,
yeah,
their war experiences.
Yeah.
And so some of the family members have been able to follow through the diaries and they'll,
right,
say at the end of it, yeah, okay, now I can understand.
It's a level of catharsis or whatever,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah, just an understanding and maybe some of the strange,
yeah,
habits that parents would have.
Yes, yeah.
I've heard stories where they'd say, oh, you know, we always had issues around food.
Yeah.
And it's,
yeah,
not surprising when you've had such,
yeah,
hunger and hardship.
Yes.
Or about having strangers coming into the house or things like that.
Yes.
And a lot of it becomes more understandable when,
yeah,
when you've seen what they've gone through.
Well, they often say that, don't they? I mean, still, you know, people that have been in war situations,
mm,
generally don't talk about it. I think it's just...
Yes.
They now say levels of PTSD or whatever, but I think it is that complete shock to the system, but also perhaps you're wanting to keep any atrocities away from anybody else. You don't want to give people bad news and you don't want,
yeah,
to talk about...
I think that's part of it.
You know.
And I think there's also a big risk of not wanting to be misunderstood.
Yes.
So I remember my dad was in the Navy in the war,
mm,
and talked about it a lot, but would always talk about the same few, like, funny stories, to the point where as a kid you just go, oh, yeah, Dad's burping on again, and you tune it out. And of course now you'd love to hear,
yes,
more and more of those stories.
Yes.
The only time he came out with a sort of a dark story was we'd watched this war movie. It was one Sunday afternoon and I wasn't very old. I was probably like in my, I don't know, 11, 12, something like that. And
yeah,
he said, oh, yeah, one time we had a group come to us that had been in a fight. And as they came up on the deck, they had these rubber boiler suits and they were falling off them and we couldn't work out what it was, and then we worked out it was their skin.
Oh.
Which is And I just didn't know what to do with that.
I know.
As a young kid, I had nothing to say.
No.
And so...
Very dark.
Very dark. That was it. And yeah. We never talked about anything like that ever again.
And maybe that memory had just come to him through that Sunday afternoon film.
I think so, yes.
Just that image that you can't erase, I suppose, but it's, you push it as far back as you can.
You can, yeah. But you
It's horrendous, isn't it, to see people in that state.
And then how do you talk about that to someone who's not been through those sort of things?
Yeah.
So I think the only time he would talk was if he was with his old mates who'd been through the same experiences.
Yeah, so what you're doing really with these diaries is you're providing this sort of service which is putting things together, which is allowing sort of stitching a patchwork quilt of what happened each day.
Yes, and together. You get different people writing about the same thing, so you get you get a broader picture of it.
Yeah.
And you get patterns as well, because you're seeing stuff happen again and again. And so, yeah, the idea was to give people a different experience, because if you read a book and you put it down and you go away, it's quite different from 4 years of trip.
Yeah, very definitely, yeah.
So that was...
So that information, that's all within the GRULO website. People can search war diaries.
Yeah, GRULO wartime diaries.
Wartime diaries are on there. I do still think there is a book in that, actually. But
this project is also building on work that other people have done. So Tony Banham's books are very much this kind of... his website is
along those lines,
the Hong Kong War Diaries. Yes, so he works on a long timeline, and he has books about the fighting, and about the Lisbon Maru, and about the people who are in the camps. He's done that.
Yeah, these
book
subjects
very well.
Are covered from other angles.
But this is because we're not limited by the space of a book.
Yeah,
this tends to be a lot more information on any one day. If you compiled the whole thing into a book, it would be quite a big tome, wouldn't it?
Yeah, because I guess if you're using people's words, their own words on their own diaries, which you do tend to sort of waffle a bit, maybe, and a book will use artistic license to slash things here, there, and everywhere. Yeah. So I think it is quite interesting to read that warts and all thing.
Warts and all is very important, because these were written without the expectation of anyone reading it.
Yeah.
They're private things.
Yes. So private thoughts.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's one of the things you've been working on. So what we're going to do now is just talk briefly about the next steps for you. So you've made a big life decision to turn into another chapter. Do you want to tell us about that and how you plan to sort of execute things?
Yeah, so the big change for us is this July we'll be heading to the UK to live. It's one of those times in life where it all makes sense. Our younger daughter will be graduating in the UK this year. Our older daughter graduates. Our younger daughter starts uni in September in the UK.
Yes.
And mum's in her 90s now, so it's just going to be close to family for the next few years at least. People then will ask, well, what's going to happen to GRULO?
Yes.
And the nice thing about it is it lives on a server in the US, so it actually makes no difference.
Be anywhere.
Yeah, I am. Yeah. So we'll keep on running that. But there is also a bit of a feeling of, well, I'll be 60 this year, and if I'm still doing this when I'm 65, is that a good thing? Should I be thinking about finding another way to run it? So I'm not giving it serious thought yet, but I can see that over the next...
Yeah.
Yeah, 4 or 5 years, it'll be time
some
to find
succession
it.
Planning of some sort.
That's right. Keep it going. Whether that's an individual or perhaps one of the universities, if they're thinking to build a project, would they be willing to come and even buy it? I don't know. Is that an option?
Yeah.
Who knows?
To me, that would make the most sense. For somebody, an institution of some sort to come in and purchase really something which is a half a life's work there of 35,000 pictures and stories and the links and the things they got to put together, that really needs to be in some sort of available to the national libraries and whatever. I think that's that would be the right thing to do from my perspective, I would have thought. For you, it's your baby. So I guess there's that sort of, argument within you. Do you want to hand over your baby? When was the right time? I mean, if it was me, I'd always want to be involved in it to a certain extent, but maybe lesser and lesser extent. So I don't know.
But we had a big upgrade of the software about 2 years ago, three years ago.
Yes.
And that turned out to be over a year's work. I mean, it was a lot of work.
Yeah.
And my software skills are pretty rusty, so there was a lot of learning to get back up to speed.
Yes.
So I'm thinking I probably wouldn't like to go through that again.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that would be one of the drivers to find someone that's willing to take it on, yeah. But the other thing you could do is to just freeze it in time and have it as a static site. So everything's there.
Yes.
You can't add to it anymore, but it's all the information is available.
Yes, a database is frozen.
So one of the things we do is have people come in and take copies that are held elsewhere.
Yeah.
So if for whatever reason, if I got knocked down by a tram and the website suddenly disappeared,
yes,
there will be copies kept elsewhere. Yeah.
Yeah, that's where your IT background comes in. It never leaves you, does it? I think you always think, right, I need multiple copies. I need them in multiple locations.
Yes, exactly.
This thing has got to be foolproof, fail-proof. So, okay, so you will leave these shores in July.
Yep.
I guess you're always going to have some association with Hong Kong after that, are you? They always say you can leave Hong Kong, but Hong Kong never leaves you.
Very true. I'm assuming that we'll be back for visits. I mean, my wife's family are all here.
Right.
She's local to Hong Kong. So that's going to be a huge draw. And then we've got so many friends and contacts here. And those walks that we love and things like that. There's always going to be a good reason to come back and
visit. Yeah, come and get back into them.
Yeah.
I was reading yesterday's update of the newsletter. Mm. And you're planning two talks. I guess now you've got this thing, and I can see it with you actually at the start of the year, that you've now got this sort of timetable of things that you're doing. Do you want to tell us a little bit about those?
Yeah, it's just a chance to do a couple of farewell talks, really. That's how we're pitching them.
Yeah.
The talks I always enjoy giving, and I think people enjoy seeing them. We show photos in quite a different way. We don't put them up like a PowerPoint, but we put up high resolution copies and we zoom in and show details and people enjoy
absolutely
that.
Absolutely love it. Yes.
So I wanted to do a little bit of a run through of how the site grew over time and why some of the reasons, without getting too nerdy and hopefully keeping it interesting.
Yeah.
And then have a section on favourite photos.
Right, okay.
Because they're really what Gulo's best known for, I think, is the photos.
Yeah.
And that, to me, is always the photo that's got a story to tell. Some of them are really obvious and some of them the stories are like hidden away in the detail. So that's always fun. A bit of detective work and telling the stories. And then we've got some personal interest stories which we've been involved in and perhaps Gulo has enabled or helped people find things.
Yeah.
Put families back in touch.
Fantastic.
Or some of this kind of explaining to people why things are like they are because of the background that their parents went through.
Yes.
And those are the ones that's what I find most touching and satisfying.
Yes.
A lot of the stuff we do with the data is very, very enjoyable in a kind of a crossword puzzle sort of way.
Yeah.
It gets that part of your brain.
Yeah.
But the bits where you've helped people is much more sort of
rewarding, isn't it?
Yeah. Touches your heart more.
Yeah, the emotional side of it, I think that's the untold story of the whole thing, actually. I think you must have many, many, many of those stories there of links that you've put together with people and families, and that service is really unmatched in that area in Hong Kong, for Hong Kong's history.
It's not a many and many, actually. It only happens a few times a year, I'd say.
Yeah.
But when it does happen, or at least that's when we hear about it.
Yes.
But when it does happen, it's very, very satisfying.
As you say, that's when you hear about it. There may be many times that people have put two and two together and found out these things by using your site. Yeah. And that's worked. Okay, so two last overviews. They are, do you want to say where they are and when they are?
Yes, we've got two dates booked. The first one is 8th of May, and that's at the Science Museum's Lecture Hall.
Right.
And they have got this beautifully sharp projector. So that's cool. What I'm looking forward to using there.
Yeah.
And then the second one is 22nd of May, and that's in the Art Centre in Wan Chai.
Okay.
In the cinema downstairs. That's another good good venue. And if anyone's interested to come along, if you go to Google and type in Eventbrite and Gulo, G-W-U-L-O,
right,
that'll take you to the booking pages.
And I understand you've created some books as well along the way, which you mentioned earlier on. What are those books about? How many are there? Where are they available?
The books came from giving talks.
Yeah.
Actually started off with giving talks, and then the talks I've compiled into the books. So the books gather some of my favourite photos that have what I think are the best stories.
Yes.
And we've ended up with a series of five books. So it's Old Hong Kong Photos and the Tales They Tell, volumes 1 to 5. You can certainly find them here at Vibe. You can find them on our website. You can find them at other bookstores around Hong Kong.
Okay. It just remains for me to say, David Bellis, thank you very much for coming today.
It's a pleasure. Thanks, Gary.
You can listen to all our Vibrations podcasts published on Spotify, Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Podbean, Amazon Music, TuneIn and Alexa, Stitcher, Listening Notes, Player FM, SoundCloud, and a few others. Or you can watch on our YouTube channel under Live at Vibe HK, or follow the links from my website at vibehk.com. The opening and closing music comes from Celestial and is called Green Island Dub and is on the Retrospect vinyl album on sale at Vibe. Finally, a reminder that Vibe is open 7 days a week, every day of the year, from 12 noon until approximately 6:30 p.m. Well, that's it for now. Thanks for listening to the 47th Vibe Book and Music Shop podcast called Vibrations. I'm Gary Brightman. You get my vibe?
Can you imagine what this old island must have looked like to those Dutch sailors when they first saw it? Fresh green. Like a dream of a new world.
They must have held their breath. Afraid it would disappear before they could touch it.